Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star one on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star two if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. We do have three questions in queue. Our first comes from the line of Toni Sacconaghi King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Toni.
Hey, Diane.
Hi.
Great presentation.
Thanks.
You guys had mentioned about the gilenia. I wanted to say that one thing that we've been noticing with a few patients that they talked about is fatigue. They seem to get that after 3 weeks, or they'll think that they're having a potential side effect or not side effect, but that they may be having an exacerbation. And we'll kind of let them know. We end up asking, have they had their urine checked, and when we bring them in and check their lab levels, it turns out that they end up having a UTI. But one of the things that we hear about is that they have, like, the fatigue also. I'm sorry, I'm trying to talk fast because my son's running around. But that was just, I didn't know if anybody shared the same comments about the fatigue with the gilenia after 3 weeks or so. Okay, so we'll open that
Maybe
for
open that
questions,
up.
If
I think one of the things in Canada that we're benefiting from is your experience in the States. Gilenia is just kind of getting up and rolling in Canada, and I think that you guys have had it on the market for certainly
Since September.
Since September.
Right.
So it's not something that I've seen so far, but I think your idea of doing some exploration of the fatigue in a little bit more detail and maybe having them come in and doing some bloods, doing some labs, seeing what's going on there. I guess I would wonder how that person's profile compared to before they started on medication and whether they had a known risk factor of urinary tract infections that might be kind of provoked or continued by some additional risk factors from gilenia. I don't know, Lori, I know you've mentioned being quite involved in studies and some phase four trials, and I'm just wondering what your experience has been.
Well, what I've noticed is that fatigue, it can be a complaint. It doesn't seem to be that frequent, but what we've been doing is having patients take it at night. Instead of taking it in the morning. And I think that's actually made a pretty significant difference with that. Also, Tony, I think you said that it started, what, 3 months down the road, or that the fatigue started, or did it start right away?
Well, I think when they switched over from their injection, they really didn't have the fatigue, but they said that after they started the gilenia, it seemed that, like, right at 3 weeks. But some of the patients, they kind of talked about it as well, and that was kind of the general consensus. So, because they weren't sure, should they stay on drug or stop drug, and then they stayed on drug and kind of worked through it. But we did kind of like Lori did and said, well, let's try at night. There's no magic number, AM or PM. And we seem to have had better results too with them staying on therapy because, I mean, our folks are quick that if it's not working, we're just going to get right off.
Well, I think one of the complaints that we've dealt with is maybe a headache. But, they may get a daily headache with it, and it's not even that bad a headache. However, it seems to last for maybe a week or two, transient on and off, and then after that, I think the fatigue that they did have with the headache just disappears. So
Okay.
that's been my experience. Doug, do we have another question? Thank you, Tony.
Thank you so much, Diane and Lori.
Thanks.
Do we have any other questions in
Yes,
queue?
we do. We have three in queue still. Our
Okay.
next comes from Patricia Pagnotta from Orlando, Florida. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Patricia.
Diane, thank you very much. That was an excellent overview for adherence. And I just wanted to comment about Gilenya briefly in that, you know, we were involved in the phase 3 trials and also have a switch trial now going on. And I guess one of the things that I can say definitely, Gilenya has no exception to adherence in what I've seen in clinical practice, but not only when you look at the studies related to other chronic diseases.
Right.
The
right.
pill form versus injection form. But, you know, most significantly, obviously, now that we can prescribe it, we've had several patients come talk, well, I want to have the pill. It would be so much easier for me to take a pill.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we go through all of the very good things that you outlined, talking about efficacy, side effects, potential risk and whatnot, some people rethink that. And we,
mm-hmm.
you know, try to... Well, this may work in your lifestyle, but are you ready to take these risks? Is your disease
mm-hmm.
needing of this if you're doing well on platform therapy? So that then, you know, helps them be more comfortable in making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But amazingly enough, I had a patient who came to us just absolutely begged and begged and begged us for Gilenya. We gave it to her. She wasn't on the drug, not even four, I think just over 4 weeks. And went on a vacation to, you know, another country.
Mm-hmm.
And actually called us and said, you know, I left my Gilenya at home.
Oh, dear.
And she's going to be gone for 2 weeks. And I'm thinking, I don't find, you know, I have more problems in my history with persons with injections, worrying about vacations, being very methodical about planning their vacations, and I'm going to have to take this injection and whatnot. They may
mm-hmm.
forget an awful lot of things, but... I've not had a patient forget their injections purposefully
right.
on vacations. Non-purposefully. I've had persons that have said, well, I'm going to take a holiday and I'm not going to take my injection with me. I'm truly going on vacation and whatnot. But this individual truly meant to take her medication with her, but because of it being so convenient, I think, she
mm-hmm.
just accidentally forgot it. So I think that that is something when we're seeing patients in follow-ups that we stress very, very, very much. Although this is convenient, make sure you're putting this pill in a place that
mm-hmm.
is very noticeable. Family is not quite as involved in persons taking pills as with injections. With
mm-hmm.
injections, we find family are much more involved in, you know,
mm-hmm.
did you get your injection, or maybe family members are helping with injections. I'm so
mm-hmm.
sorry, Mother Poon. That has helped families be involved and help patients be more supportive, where I've not seen that with Gilenya.
Right.
And as far as the fatigue, you know, I've had that go two ways with Gilenya. I've had patients come in who had shared with me prior to going off of injection therapies, feeling like they were not having any flu-like side effects. They were tolerating it very well. They come back on Gilenya for their first four-week appointment and just describe, just like persons who go from an interferon to Tysabri,
mm-hmm.
oh, that they didn't even recognize that they had some of this still hanging around until they're off the drug. So I think that that kind of goes two ways, but very much assessing for the risk of Gilenya is, I think, imperative. And those other things that happen, like minor infections and, you know, the cough sometimes. We've had patients develop a cough that sometimes can be problematic if they don't know about that. That can occur at 3 months.
That's right. I didn't quite hear that. They developed what?
They get almost like a ACE inhibitor type of cough that you get.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Some patients are experiencing that at 3 months, and if they don't know, they all of a sudden they start having this dry hacking cough that is truly just a drug reaction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything, you know, because we've gone through testing people's pulmonary studies, the whole nine yards, to be clear that they're not having any of that S1P1 receptor in their pulmonary tree, and truly it's just one of those rare side effects that can occur, and it's documented from the studies, but so that's something, another thing to just remind them
yeah.
of that we've seen. But
yeah, I think you brought up some really terrific points. You know, one just around the whole idea of adherence, and I think we assume that somehow adherence is all related to the fact that people don't like to take injections. and that somehow if we make it easier, if it's a pill, that they will do that. And as you're, you know, mentioning very well, and certainly the studies, you know, that are out there in terms of diabetes or chemotherapy or some of the mental health disorders, they have their own struggles. You know, people still, you know, don't remember to take the medication. They don't maybe get the benefit that they think that they should or that they want. And so why should I bother taking this expensive medication over the long term if I'm not feeling better or if I continue to sort of see myself worsen? So I think there's some motivational issues, some problem-solving issues around, you know, kind of keeping on therapy. You know, there's a whole kind of focus on motivational interviewing and how to kind of work collaboratively with patients, really to look at their health goals and ways of achieving that over time, and not just maybe looking at sort of the sort of short term, but also the long term. And then kind of that self-monitoring. How are people going to kind of, you know, remember to take the medication? You talked about that as well, that, you know, if it's not sort of an injection, somehow it's not perceived to be quite as serious, the amount of planning and sort of preparation that goes into traveling with a medication is a little bit different. So people may need to have different kinds of reminder boxes. We've given feedback to the people at Novartis that we would like to see kind of a pill pack or a blister pack of some kind, so that people can remember whether they've taken it or not, or to use kind of event reminders on their cell phone, on their iPad, that kind of thing, or their kitchen timers. And so, you know, traditionally we use pen and paper and calendars, I think, but I think people are developing now apps for, you know, reminding people just to take their medications. And as you say, I think we need to kind of get family members, keep family members engaged in sort of starting on treatment and keeping on treatment. I think the other thing, Patricia, that I heard was just some of these other kinds of possible side effects to the medication that maybe aren't so clearly written in the product monograph. And it's only when we have the numbers and the volumes of patients over time that we really start to sort of see what is this real life experience going to be, and then how can we coach people about what's normal, what maybe is actionable. As Tony was saying, some of these patients have urinary tract infections, but you're saying, say, maybe people have a cough, you know, that might just be kind of a drug reaction or a rare side effect, that it doesn't necessarily herald anything very serious. But I think you brought up some very important points about what we need to be sort of addressing with patients, and also, you know, the kinds of education that we need to provide, but also some of the kind of, you know, as they say, problem solving and helping people to take more of an active role in their self-monitoring of symptoms, but also on the number of treatments they're taking, and to really sort of have sort of multifaceted strategies, I guess, to really target behavioral changes around starting and staying on treatment.
Okay.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patricia. We really appreciate your input. I think we have about 3 questions in queue right now.
Good.
Doug, would you like to go to the next question?
Certainly. Our next comes from the line of Brenda Moss from San Antonio, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Brenda.
Brenda Moss, your line is live.
She's stepped back.
Maybe she's having.
I heard lots of kids and lots of.
Are you muted on your side, Brenda?
What does she need to press, Doug?
If she might have muted it on her phone, the mute button.
Oh, I see.
Maybe she'll come back.
Okay,
let's go to the next one.
All right, sure. Brenda, come back.
Our next one comes from the line of Marlene Cleven from Seattle, Washington. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, this is Marlene.
Hi, Marlene.
I was wondering if you or any of you are aware of any kind of validated tool that's available for measuring or assessing prior adherence behaviors and the relationship that might have to current or future adherence behaviors.
Mm.
It's really great to, you know, hear nurses being involved with these clinical decisions with patients, but, you know, oftentimes there are offices where there maybe only be a medical assistant there, and the physicians are kind of, you know, giving these kits out to patients and saying, choose the one you want. And Mm-hmm. I was just, you know, interested in any kind of tool that might be available, because I think prior behaviors are usually at least somewhat predictive of current behaviors.
Right, right.
I think that's really a very good point. Diane, do you know of
it's
anything?
It's a good point. I'm just trying to think if I read anything about adherence. I'm not sure that I read about an adherence tool,
mm-hmm.
But I think your point about, you know, depending on who's in the office and who's available to counsel patients, one of the, I'm going to kind of segue into a little bit of a different area, but because you talked about decision making, and mm-hmm. one of the tools that I have looked at, and that Colleen Harris and I did a workshop at CMSC, was looking at the Ottawa Decision Support Tool. So it's not really looking at adherence. It's a good point. Maybe we could look to see if there are some tools out there, but it more looked at tools to help people make decisions about a treatment that was right for them. And this Ottawa decision support framework really looks at having patients list the what they know about the benefits of the different choices, what they know about the different risks,
mm-hmm.
looking at what's of value to them, like of those things, then, you know, what is it that I really value? So, you know, people, you know, some people may say if there's any risk at all, I don't want to take a particular medication. I'd rather go with what's safe, even if the efficacy may be less. But it really kind of helps you to kind of guide the person through the decision-making process about values, what kind of support would they like to have in terms of making the decision, because I think it's all very well and good to talk about collaborative decision-making, but I don't think everybody is really wanting to take that role. It may have to do in part with education and age and kind of people's experience with maybe making those kinds of decisions in the past,
mm-hmm.
but one of the questions that I ask people, if we are offering them a treatment choice or offering to them to participate in that choice, is, you know, how is it that they really do want to be involved? And I think that, you know, sort of checking in with them, are they wanting us to make the decision? Do they want to make that decision alone? Or do they see that as a shared decision? I think is one of the things that I often talk about with patients. So I recognize, Brenda, that's a little different from the question that you're asking about prior adherence behaviors. And I'm just wondering, is there anything that you've seen in that regard yourself?
Yeah, I have seen, you know, just a trend towards, you know, people who, you know, one of my questions in a previous nursing position was, you know, at the end of an antibiotic route, how many pills do you have left?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that was usually pretty indicative of, you know, of how adherent they were going to be with a particular type of therapy, or whether they were going to be able to persevere
mm-hmm.
through keeping it. And I was just wondering if there was a tool. But this Ottawa Decision Support Tool framework, is that available anywhere online, or is that?
It is actually. If you go
to
www.ohri.
Mm-hmm.
I've just forgotten whether it's .ca or .com, but
if you
type in OHRI, it should come up. And they have a whole team. It's a nurse who actually has a whole research unit on decision support.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a lot of work with decision aids and developing and validating decision aids for various treatments, but actually for any kind of health decision. So it might be, you know, medication A versus medication B. It might be, do I want to take chemotherapy versus surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be, I mean, they have some sort of obscure things like, you know, should I put my mother-in-law in a nursing home, or do I, you know, do I want to have a ventilatory assistance if I have a degenerative illness?
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of, it does a couple of things. It sort of, I think, is a tool that patients can use on their own, but ideally, I think it's something that is used in conjunction with a nurse or another health professional, and it doesn't work so well as a freestanding item. I think it's kind of part of a larger program that they have on decision coaching and how to help patients to make a decision that's right for them. So, but part of it, I think, is really the main thing is really looking at risks and benefits, values, decision support, and kind of decision dilemmas that they may be facing. And I think it's a really interesting tool.
I look forward to looking at it.
Oh, I was going to say, Diane, it's not proprietary. It is available to anybody.
It is available. It's online, and they do make it available for people. I think if you want to distribute it widely, or use it, say, as part of a research study, I think they do ask that you write them and let them know.
But it's quite
available. Absolutely.
Well, that's great information. That's good to know. Good question, Marlene.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe if we find anything on that adherence kind of evaluation, is there a mechanism to put something up on the IOMSM website, Lori? Or
sure, I think that would be a great idea, and we can also put that out to our listeners and, you know, see if any of them know of anything available.
Maybe if there's anybody else online who has seen something as well. Certainly the focus is often on, coaching for medication adherence. And first of all, looking at some of the factors, but then, you know, really focusing kind of on the behavioral on the behavioral strategies and the sort of self-efficacy strategies, but then getting that kind of provider support and surveillance both from family as well as the nurse.
But might be able to guide them toward a decision that was going to be better for them in the long run.
Right.
If you know up front that, you know, that they really are not somebody that's going to do something every single day, well, maybe we could guide you towards something else rather than, you know, saying, well, my neighbor takes this, so that's what I'm going to take.
Exactly. And we hear a lot of that, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. You know, sure your support group, you know, did say this, but, you know, realistically, do you see this as something that you can start and stay on? And often people don't sort of see that as being the best option for them. Yeah.
Great discussion point.
Great. Thanks for your call.
Let's go on and move on to the next question, Doug. I know we have a couple.
Yes. Brenda Moss from San Antonio, Texas. Please proceed with your question. Your line is live.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Brenda.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. That was a great overview. Hi, Lori. How are you doing?
Hi, Brenda.
I didn't really have a question so much as I do a statement. I just can't overemphasize how important it is to have a positive attitude from the nurses. I know oftentimes my role was more of a cheerleader.
Right.
And so, or has been more of a cheerleader, and that seems to mirror that to the patient and motivates them to be more adherent with their therapy, whatever that therapy may be. So I really think a lot of times that with our positive attitude, I think that really does encourage that patient to be more adherent.
Can you share with us a little bit some of the things that you do to keep positive yourself and also to communicate that to patients? What kind of messages do you send?
Well, what I try to do is basically teach them step back and look at the bigger picture. There is a bigger picture there, and what benefits of staying on therapy and being adherent long term can mean for that patient, as to improve, you know, their mobility, as that may be, or whatever problems they're having at the time, because everyone, it's a little different for everyone, of course, as you know, during the disease process. But what we can do as a whole, to help that patient. You have to, you know, of course, take a holistic approach, and you're not just, you know, talking about one specific thing, of course, it's everything. But just with me having a positive attitude and saying, hey, this is not hopeless. A lot of times patients think that their diagnosis or their prognosis is hopeless, and when in fact it's not.
Right.
It can be a very hopeful thing. And so I think a lot of times, you know, there's an old school of thought that this is a hopeless situation when, in fact, it's not, and especially in light of all the new lines of therapy that are out there now.
Right.
So, and this is actually a very exciting time for our patients because we do have several lines of therapy
mm-hmm.
out there and more coming.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, Brenda. I mean, first of all, I think your strategy of looking kind of at the holistic approach is really very much in keeping with, you know, looking at the big picture and not just focusing on the treatment, but focusing on, you know, where is this patient going? Where do they see themselves? What are they hopeful for themselves? What are their goals for themselves, but also for their family over time? And how, you know, what is it that they hope to have with respect to their health in 5, 10, 20 years? And keeping them kind of focused on the big picture and, as I say, kind of setting that expectation of kind of collaboration with respect to their health, and also that they have a key role in having very active participation in their own self-management, which we know from the literature as well results in better health outcomes. And I think for some of us who have been in the field for a long time, I think maintaining that hope is important for us. It's important that we communicate that to our patients. But likewise, you know, some of us were in the field before the medications became available. And then
right.
the beta-saron came on the market. It started slowly, and we all know how it's expanded over time. So I think if people are getting discouraged, if they're worried that they're not getting the response that they want, or they're hopeful that they're losing hope that maybe things are going to improve, I think that idea of just this kind of huge expansion, this exponential expansion in terms of research and treatments, that, you know, if these are the treatments that we have now, we will have better treatments in the future, and kind of
Absolutely.
Keeping people going and motivated, I think, and hopeful, as you say, is really a big part of all of this.
Right, absolutely. Empowering those patients is, mm-hmm. is a very, very important tool. So, yes.
Right,
okay.
Right. And what is it that we're doing in the way we practice that sort of enhances that empowerment, eh? I mean, how do we talk with people? How do we set expectations of their participation, you know, kind of right at the outset? So it's not just empowering them with the medication, but in all aspects of kind of taking charge of their health. So that's a very
Absolutely.
Good point. Thanks. That's great. Thanks, Brenda.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Brenda. Good discussion. I think we still have one more in queue, Doug, right?
Yes, that is correct. Our
Great.
Next comes from the line of Tony Saladena King from Houston, Texas. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks.
Hi, Tony again.
Hey, Diane again. I was going to ask you guys if there was maybe something that would help identify maybe high-risk patients, like what are some cues that we could look for in some of the patients. I know Carol had worked with Teva about developing that high-risk patient and, you know, that they may need a little bit more TLC or hand-holding.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I didn't know if there was a paper or anything
mm-hmm.
out there maybe about identifying some high-risk patients that
mm-hmm.
might not be adherent.
Mm-hmm. There was a study that was done certainly by the Teva group, as you mentioned. I think that was published in 2007, and the authors were Parker and Beach.
Okay.
And they talked about that, you know, identifying kind of an algorithm to identify those most at risk. I don't think they went into a lot of details about what those risk factors were. Maybe did Carol publish a paper on that, in fact, that you are aware of, Tony? Or
That I don't remember. I know that she had helped pilot the model with Teva. I'm not
mm-hmm.
sure if there was a paper to follow with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure either.
Yeah, Laura, you were saying that you had had I think asked about that at one point in time, and it wasn't necessarily kind of readily available.
It was more proprietary, right? It wasn't really available because
mm-hmm.
I thought that could be very helpful. Although they do a great job, I think
they do, but they don't share.
No,
right.
No. Not share. Maybe not share the tools, but they do let us know
mm-hmm.
when. And I appreciate that from the support, the
right.
pharmaceutical support programs that they have.
Mm-hmm.
They will identify somebody and let us know
mm-hmm.
if they think.
Right.
And where we could maybe intervene a little bit.
Yeah, I think the paper was really, this particular paper, maybe their role was not to discuss that necessarily, or to the emphasis of the paper was not necessarily to kind of share those factors as much as to I think talk about the role of support programs in general. And what they found was that when nurses did use those algorithms, that in fact patient adherence did increase beyond sort of that 90-day period, which is kind of a difficult sort of turning point. So it just, for me, it also just provided some rationale for involving the patient support programs at the start of treatment. You know, I know in my own practice we have over 4,000 patient visits a year, and close to, I think, about 3,000 to 3,500 patients registered. So, you know, we have a tremendous number of patients, and so we really count on those kind of collaborations. I think certainly what some of the studies have shown is, are those patients who are having difficult side effects that are hard to manage. The degree of disability may also be a factor. So if some patients are on the injectable therapies, if they already are having difficulties with spasticity and fatigue, some of the interferons may provoke that or may worsen that. So if people are having more side effects on treatment than they did with, you know, sort of off treatment, they may sort of feel as though that's not a reason to continue treatment over time. And certainly, I think, you know, as you mentioned, kind of those that checking in about both side effects, but also what is their perception of the benefit. If their people are not seeing an improvement, even though we may have counseled them that that's not necessarily what we would expect to see as a role of the treatment, they're also have been identified as being off, sort of at more risk. Some of the other things you did talk about was income and coverage, that some people do stop treatment because of coverage issues, and that those in a lower income were more at risk. Younger patients maybe tended to be at a time of their life where maybe taking responsibility for a treatment was a little bit difficult to do, and that there may be a racial component, although that particular study was quite small, so I don't think we would want to overgeneralize. I think the other piece is certainly the cognitive and depression issues, that people who have some cognitive changes may not be able to kind of pull it all together to do their treatments, or may not remember them, may have difficulty just kind of with those that executive task of actually taking medication over time. And certainly if people are depressed, they may not stay on treatment either. So I think those are certainly some of the things that we that are identified in the literature, but certainly I think that we could all kind of predict from our practice as maybe being a bit of an issue. So treating the depression, building in supports for those who have cognitive impairment, optimizing the symptom control as much as possible, not keeping people on a particular therapy if they're really suffering, but, you know, we try to ensure people that if the side effects are that difficult, we will do something, we will make a change, and we'll either, you know, make a change in the dosage or how we're managing it, or it may even mean a change in medication, but that they're reassured that we're not going to keep them on something that's going to be sort of intolerable for sure.
Okay. Diane, thank you. And Tony, thank you for your question.
Thank you.
And we'll put that out to, we have a couple more people in queue.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, would you like to go ahead and go to the next question?
Certainly. Our next question comes from the line of Jennifer Schmarka from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Lori. Hi there. Diane, I'm sorry to say I missed the part of your presentation, but I've just been listening for about the last 25 minutes, and it's been a great discussion, and
yeah.
I just wanted to ask you to comment on some of your techniques for motivational interviewing, and how has that been utilized in your practice, and have you been able to see the benefits of getting patients to be more compliant just in your own practice?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of kind of sort of strategies that kind of go along, I think, with motivational interviewing. And I think, first of all, having sort of clear, kind of manageable, you know, sort of measurable goals in terms of, you know, what people sort of see for themselves, how they're going to actually kind of make things happen. So I think sometimes when we talk about sort of the ask, tell, ask strategy, we're asking, you know, questions about what do people want to know, asking permission to give them information or to correct some information or share some information that you may have, and then sort of asking again to, you know, how do people understand that information, or can you, you know, repeat back to me what it was we discussed or how we're going to proceed or how you, you know, how you're going to manage a particular side effect and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, keeping it very kind of collaborative, sort of setting some small measurable goals for how somebody might, you know, remember to take a medication, for example, or to, you know, get started on a medication, stay on a medication. But part of it, I think, is checking in with them about what they understand, how they're going to proceed, and that sort of thing. So I think the other thing that goes along with that is, you know, really trying to be very collaborative with the person. And by that I mean, you know, not sort of delivering information that's not, they're not ready for, really expressing empathy for some of the challenges, I think, of sort of staying on treatment. You know, if people are having difficulty, you know, sort of staying on treatment, then, you know, recognizing that they're sort of stopping treatment may be what they need to do at a particular point in time, but maybe working with them to explore what are ways that might enable them to get back on. So you're kind of opening up for discussion if there is some sort of resistance or some reluctance to continue on treatment, you know, and that reluctance may be our signal to kind of respond differently or to take a particular, a different tack. So I think that those are some of the things. Is that something that you've used at all?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think just listening to you, I was chuckling to myself because I thought, gosh, you're such a great negotiator. You might be able to do like hostage negotiations after this. because I think
what have you done in your practice?
I mean, I think we do a lot of health coaching and kind of, you know, kind of what you had said before too, is you really rely on all of your nursing skills of assessment and determine kind of just with your interaction with the patient of what is their, you know, what's their kind of threshold for risk in that, you know.
Right.
Do they seem like they are somebody who regularly exercises? Do they wear their seatbelts? Do they smoke? You know, are they heavy drinkers? You kind of assess everything, and that also helps to kind of give you some sense of whether they're going to be actively, you know, adherent with their medications and invested and committed to it.
Right. Kind of gets back to what Marlene was talking about, prior adherence behaviors, and you're talking about prior risky behaviors.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thanks,
I think I think that those are all kind of good things to be looking at. You know, I think the reality is that sometimes our patients may come off treatment for a while, or they may be reluctant to start. And you know, sometimes what I've asked people is, okay, you've decided not to start treatment, or you've decided to stop your treatment. What would be a situation that would make you think differently about your treatment? And as we know, often they will say, well, if I have another attack or if I have an MRI that shows more lesions. And I think being able to stay engaged with them because of the long-term nature of MS, even if they're not ready now to start or to stick to treatment, at another point in time that may change. So then I'll ask them for permission, you know, would it be okay if we bring this up from time to time when we meet? And if something that you've identified as being a motivator for you to change your mind comes up, maybe let's talk about that again. And I'll refer back to that. Remember when you told me that if you had another relapse, you might be willing to revisit treatment. Is this a time when we can talk about that again? So I think sort of that respect and that waiting and kind of rolling with that, you know, that sort of falling off behavior, I think is another strategy that we can just, I think, help to stay our patients to stay engaged with us, and then maybe at a later point in time get re-engaged with treatment.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks,
Diane. We have 5 minutes left, and I think we have one more question in the queue that maybe we could take that real quickly, Doug.
Yes, our last question comes from the line of Carol Saunders from Oceanside, California.
Oh.
Please proceed with your question.
Hi, I'm that Carol that I think Tony referred to when we were talking about a Teva study, and I just thought I'd straighten out what we were trying to do in that study.
Yeah.
We were trying to look at how we could increase adherence with patients if the nurse in the office and a nurse at Teva, it happened to be Teva, at the company that was trying to help the patient as well, work together. And we would then identify patients that they thought were high risk, and we would identify patients we thought were high risk. And I think that in our identifying those patients, we're using the very same things that Diane has been talking about, and those of us that have been talking on this is what we. It's kind of an intuition. If you talk with the patient, you know that they're going to be at risk. And it was very helpful to have a nurse that you could talk to that would also work with the patient.
Right. I think that's a very good point. So that kind of teamwork and working collaboratively, or as you say, working in partnership, I think is really important because, as I say, there's thousands of calls that come through, and I think that having that additional kind of colleague through the patient support programs, I think, is very important. I think we also try to make it clear when we try to have regular meetings, or at least meetings perhaps on a yearly basis with some of the nurses from the patient support program, so that we have some clarity at which point in time do we really need to be getting the message that someone is not doing well, and if there's reasons why people are dropping off therapy or if they're struggling with their therapy, that really we really need to be knowing about that. So I think we try to communicate that with our partners at the patient support programs, but also giving that message to patients as well. Under what circumstances do we really need to be hearing from them if they're really struggling with a particular medication issue?
Diane, I'm sorry to interrupt you. And Carol, thank you for clarifying for that. We have 2 minutes left. So I would just like to say thank you, Diane. That was excellent. And thank you, everyone, for calling in. On behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I'd like to thank Diane again for her presentation and Biogen IDEC for supporting the programs. And I hope that you'll join us next month when Patricia Pagnotti will be presenting Cognitive Impairment in MS. What is it and what can the MS nurse do? Thank you again for joining us this evening, and this concludes tonight's meeting. Hope you all have a good night.
Thanks.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude tonight's teleconference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time and have a wonderful night.